Our reading this morning begins the 14th chapter of the Gospel of Luke. First six verses. And it came to pass as he went into the house of one of the chief Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath day, that they watched him. And behold, there was a certain man before him which had the dropsy. Best I can determine the idea of this word is that I think the medical term today is edema. The fluids in the body build up rather than being drained off. And so this man had excessive body fluids, and it was probably painful. It was disabling. Very obvious. And Jesus answering spake unto the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day? And they held their peace. And he took him, the man with dropsy, and healed him, and let him go. And answered them, saying, Interesting, there's no record of them asking a question, or in any way they're silent, but he knows what's in their heart. So he's giving them an answer to a question that we don't hear. Which of you shall have an ass or an ox fallen into a pit and will not straightway pull him out on the Sabbath day? And they could not answer him again these things. A couple of interesting questions for us to begin thinking about this lesson. Is there ever a time when it's not right to do the right thing? Secondly, how do we as people today, in our family, in our home, in our workplace, in the neighborhood, wherever we interact with other people, we encounter people who have a very different idea or worldview than we have. How do we treat them? How do we interact with them? One thing that really strikes me about this lesson is that, let me give you a contrast. There are two people right here who fully are going to understand what I say. We all grew up in the Deep South. There was a very entrenched and understood culture in the Deep South. You're visiting with friends or family, and you're ready to part, and how do you say goodbye? Y'all come. And what does that mean? If you're in the neighborhood, if you think about us, you don't have to call. You don't have to wait for an invitation. Drop by. Come on in. And the welcome mat is out. We'll be glad to break what we're doing and sit down and visit with you. That's not common in most cultures. And it was not common in New Testament times in the Jewish culture. Jesus is in a chief of the Pharisees' home by invitation from the man. We have repeatedly, in all four of the Gospels, and just recently in Luke's Gospel, encountered Jesus healing on the Sabbath, and the leaders in the public places react with disgust, with rejection, with anger, and sometimes even plotting to kill Jesus because he dared to heal someone on the Sabbath. This guy is a chief in the Pharisees' culture, but he's not the same as those people. Jesus asked the question that for this man's associates in public that he has known about and probably observed would inflame them. This man and those with him are silent. Why did they invite, of all people, Jesus to sit with him for bread, for a common meal? Why did they not attack Jesus when he asked the question? It's a very different culture with these people. Something is different in their life than in the other lives of the people we've seen attacking Jesus. It's not unlike this man called Nicodemus, who in John 3 goes to Jesus by night and honors him. And there are people who think based on some linguistic hints, that this man may have been actually a member of the Sanhedrin court. But he was definitely high up in the ladder of the culture of the day. He asked Jesus questions rather than to tell Jesus what he thinks Jesus doesn't know. Jesus teaches the man what he needs to know, just as he's teaching these men what they need to know. Then we get to John, I believe it's chapter 19. Jesus has been crucified, and Joseph of Arimathea, apparently a very wealthy man in Jerusalem, and a believer in Jesus, accompanied by, what's the man's name? Nicodemus. Go to the authorities and beg permission to take the body of Jesus down from the cross and give him a respectful burial. Interesting. John's gospel also records in the 12th chapter, verse 11, that because Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, there were many of the Jews who believed on Jesus. In verse 42 of chapter 12, nevertheless, among the chief rulers, also many believed on him, but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. They believed, they cared, they honored him as being the Messiah, God incarnate, but they were fearful of their standing and position with the leadership. And so they believed on him, but were quiet. Many years ago, a lot of Primitive Baptist preachers were on different radio stations across the Eastern Seaboard and the Deep South, and one or two were very popular and were sending out weekly sermons on strong radio signals. I was talking years later with a young man who at the time was a preacher in another denomination. He started hearing one of those men preach. He was preaching on Sunday night. And he made it, he began to feel convicted about what the man was preaching. He was still pastor of a church of another persuasion. And one Sunday night, he was driving a group of young people home after their church service, and he turned on the radio to listen to that preacher. And the young people started hearing what the preacher was saying, and they were making light of it and even joking and teasing about how ridiculous what this man was saying was. And this man was all the more convicted. Not long thereafter, he joined a Primitive Baptist church and became an elder in the Primitive Baptist church. And he told me in the conversation, he said, "Brother Joe, I made a change, but I can tell you based on firsthand knowledge, there is a massive number of preachers and other persuasions who listen and believe what that man preaches, but they're afraid to speak out and make a change." The more things change, the more they're all the same. They don't change. We can assume, based on all of these thoughts, that this chief of the Pharisees had much more sympathy toward Jesus, if not outright belief, than his peers. If they were willing to rescue one of their farm animals from a pit rather than let them die on the Sabbath day, Jesus' reasoning is obvious. If that's not wrong, why should you think it wrong that I heal a child of Abraham on the Sabbath day? Who's more important, a farm animal or a child of God? They didn't answer because they didn't want to disagree with Jesus. And that brings me to a point where I want to spend some time, maybe the balance of my time. How do we live in this world? I received a very interesting question from a preacher friend of mine this week. He said, "Is it appropriate for Christians to to be friends with and to interact with unbelievers and atheists or agnostics in this world. And I wrote him back and I said, number one, based on the closing verses of 1 Corinthians 5, you couldn't live in this world without such interaction. And number two, the biblical example is the mere opposite of isolation and alienation of everyone outside of our circle of faith. I want to call your attention to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and look at Paul's lesson there. I will affirm deeply my conviction that Paul is exemplifying exactly what Jesus did on this and many other occasions. 1 Corinthians 9, begin with verse 19. Paul has before this in the chapter taught a rather clear lesson that it is a church's spiritual obligation to try as best they can to take financial care of their pastor. It is a sin for modern preachers to make money their God and then demand the church to support them. But it is a gracious, godly thing for a church, to the extent possible, to take care of their pastor. Years ago, Brother Danny Verona and I were chatting. He was a dear friend. I came to dearly love that man over the years. And he always would address me in a way that brought a smile, Brother Joe. And I knew when he said, Brother Joe, there was a question coming. And he said, you never preach on giving and money in the church. And yet it seems like at Bellflower Church, all the financial needs are met. Everything's taken care of. How do you explain that? First of all, I teased Brother Danny, and I said, Brother Danny, if you feed sheep, they grow wool. And secondly, I made the point that this church has always been a caring, giving church. We go back, Brother Jim, and you'll remember this, to when we first merged the two churches. The church had an obligation, a debt, to finish paying off this building. And the people were poor. Sometimes they only gave me a couple of $100 a month. But I didn't resent it. That was okay with me. They did the best they could. And over the years, as the church has become better off, you still give according to your heart. And you are, in my opinion, a very liberal and gracious church on those things. But Paul takes us to a more important form of giving. A cute story about an associational meeting in the state of Texas. Friday night, it's been a burning hot day. People are tired, they're sweaty, and of all the crazy things, they put three preachers up to preach on Friday night. That's torture. That's persecution of the saints. First preacher preaches on financial giving. Second preacher gets up and preaches on financial giving. And the third preacher gets up and says, Brethren, we've heard two good and biblical sermons about financial giving. I want to talk, too, about giving in the church. And there were audible groans heard from the congregation. But this preacher started preaching about giving spiritually and the giving of the heart and the Lord's giving to us, and we, by what he gives to us, share the gift of spiritual giving with others. Paul transitions that same way. He's talking about giving on another level and in another way now. Beginning with verse 19. For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more. Paul said, I don't have a moral obligation to anyone. I'm free of that. I don't owe anyone anything, and yet I owe God a debt. I love Brother John Wallace Thrower's point when someone says, you ought to forgive that person who's done you wrong. And our reaction humanly is, that person doesn't deserve my forgiveness. And Brother John Wallace says, does God deserve you doing what he tells you in forgiving that person? Yes, God does deserve it. Paul says, I am free, but I have made myself. I made the personal choice to be servant, not lord over, servant unto all. Paul consciously put himself in the role of a servant. That's what biblical discipleship is really all about. That's what biblical ministry is really all about. A person who wants to enter the ministry for prestige, for honor, for being able to tell people what to do, needs to stay as far away from the pulpit as people can keep him. The only person who needs to be here is a person with a servant's heart. What can I do for you? How can I help your cross be lighter today? That's Paul. And his objective, that I might gain the more. And unto the Jews, I became as a Jew. To them that are under the law, I became as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without law, Gentiles, as without law. I want to pause there and deal with the parenthetic expression in a moment. Let's look at how Paul did this. In Acts 15, Paul and some other members representing the church at Antioch go to the church and apostles and elders at the church in Jerusalem because some of Jerusalem church's members had gone to Antioch. Jerusalem church, guess what, is a Jewish church in Jerusalem. Antioch church was a Gentile church. These Jewish believers still held on to some of the habits of the law. Diet, for one. They still wanted people, and they practiced a kosher diet. They go to Antioch church, and they see people eating, and they don't bother whether this is kosher or not. And they begin to scold and attack Antioch church members for their careless diet. Paul had a very strong debate with them, and when that didn't work, it was agreed that they would go to Jerusalem church, where these men were members, and raise the question with Jerusalem church, as Jesus in the Pharisee's house raised the obvious question, not as an attack, not as an excuse for debate, but as a teaching learning moment. After a great deal of discussion with the apostles and in the presence of Jerusalem church, Jerusalem church agreed, we didn't send these guys and we don't agree with what they taught. And they sent a letter to Antioch church. However, in their letter to Antioch church, they put a little bit of a Jewish jab. Don't eat things offered to idols. That wasn't in an idol temple. It was eating meat at the butcher shop that had been used in an idol temple as a servant, as an offering to the gods. Don't do that. Well, Paul didn't argue with them. He took the letter. However, when Paul is interacting with a primarily Gentile church in Corinth, 1 Corinthians, there has been obviously a big controversy about eating meats offered to idols. And does Paul tell them what Jerusalem church, a Jewish church, advised to Antioch, a Gentile church? No. He tells them that if you can eat this meat with a clear conscience and understand God gave it to you, the idol didn't, and thank God for the food, eat it. However, if a weak brother observes this and he is deceived and deceives himself and thinks by doing this you're worshiping the idol, for the sake of your brother, not for anything moral, abstain. Respect the brotherhood and the well-being of your brothers and sisters in Christ. What does Paul do? He's becoming all things to all men to gain the more. There is nothing in the Gospels in the New Testament that says you must eat a kosher diet. Quite the opposite. Paul, writing to Timothy, says anything that is humanly acceptable as food is acceptable if you eat it with thanksgiving. Thank God for giving it to you and enjoy your meal. Now, still in verse 21, the parenthetic expression. Let me read the whole verse. To them that are without law, as without law. If you have ever talked to someone about your belief in salvation all and only by the sovereign grace of God, with no human contribution whatever, you're going to hear an argument. Well, if I believe that, I'd go out and just sin to my heart's content because I'm not under the law but under grace. Under the law but under grace, Paul wrote by inspiration in Romans 6 and he said, you're not under the law but under grace. So you're arguing with Paul? Who's going to win that argument? Being not without law to God, because you're under grace, doesn't mean you have no obligation to God. The very opposite. But under the law to Christ. It's subtle, but you find it in Romans 6 and many other passages. Paul's dealing here with two different laws. The law of Moses, the moral code of God, universal. It existed before Moses received it on Mount Sinai. It has never not existed. It's the moral government of God over his people, over humanity. And the law of grace, the law of God written in your heart, the law of Christ, exemplified by his teachings and his life in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapters 5 to 7. These two laws do not contradict each other. In no point is one contradicting the other. They are perfectly harmonious. Both come from God, but there is a tremendous difference between them. The interjection of Jesus, who translates and interprets the law of God through the lens of divine grace. And if you study the Sermon on the Mount, rather than the law of grace relaxing the standard, it increases the standard. You can get away under Moses' law within your heart saying, he's a fool. But what does Jesus say in the sermon? You say it in your heart, you're in trouble. You bring yourself under the chastening judgment of God. Under Moses' law, violators of certain parts of the moral code faced stoning to death. I love a beautiful passage in Psalm 89. It's a prophecy on the surface of David's successors in generations to come as kings over the nation of Israel and Judah. In fact, the reality of that lesson is a prophecy of the greater David and the dynasty of the Lord Jesus Christ. If his children break my laws, I'll chasten them with the rod. I will visit their stripes with my judgment. And then he says, nevertheless, here's where the law of Christ enhances and improves and interprets the law of God through the lens of divine loving grace. Nevertheless, my loving kindness will I not take utterly from him, nor suffer my faithfulness to fail. If God abandoned one of his own children and left him to spend eternity in the burning pit, he would violate his own faithfulness to his promise that you would be with him in glory. And God's not going to do that, David says.